Welcome to Hematologic Oncology Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. One of the most important recent developments in medical oncology has been the recent evolution of JAK2 inhibitors in myelofibrosis, and I met with Dr. Ruben Mesa for his take on this, and he began our conversation by providing an overview.
I view the myeloproliferative disorders / neoplasms, really as a group of chronic leukemias. These are a group of clonal disorders. They had always been called disorders, but largely that term, which dates back to the 50s, one of the first presidents of ASH had coined that term, combining chronic myeloid leukemia, essential thrombocythemia, myelofibrosis, and PVERA as kind of a group. We recognize now that they're clonal, they're chronic leukemias, they can progress to acute leukemia. So that's why in 2008, the World Health Organization decided to rename them neoplasms, myeloproliferative neoplasms, just to kind of make the biology a bit more clear in terms of the term. And biologically, quite a bit has been learned over these last few years. They're a group of chronic leukemias, and in 2005 was really a watershed moment for these diseases when we started to make some inroads into understanding the pathogenesis of the disorders, with the discovery of the JAK2 V617F mutation.
And could you chat a little bit more about how that's involved in the pathophysiology of this disease and also where cytokines fit in?
Sure. Well, very good question. Well, first, we know the JAK2 V617F is a mutation in JAK2. The JAK2 is part of the JAK-STAT pathway. And you can think that this is a tyrosine kinase pathway that acts as a stimulus for cells to grow and to divide. So to some degree, it is parallel to our understanding of BCR-ABL in patients with chronic myeloid leukemia. Now, a big distinguisher between the MPNs and CML is since 2005, we found that the JAK2 mutation is only part of the biological story, as opposed to BCR-ABL, which is a much more clear and initiating mutation in CML. So at this point, we think the JAK2 mutation is a middle step in the story. It's probably not the change that truly initiates the disease, and we recognize now that there are a whole series of additional mutations in MPL, in TET2, in other areas that probably contribute to the pathogenesis. So our understanding of the pathogenesis really remains incomplete, but we're finding more and more portions of the pathogenetic pathway. Now, you'd asked about cytokines. We recognize that there's both drivers of the chronic leukemia, which might be pro-stimulatory changes, such as the JAK2 mutation, and that there are a whole consequence of secondary things which happen with patients, which can be the development of serious symptoms, the development of an enlarged spleen, the development of fibrosis or scarring in the bone marrow. We do recognize that a whole variety of inflammatory and fibrotic cytokines are increased in the bloodstream and in the marrow of patients with MPNs, and that these cytokines are probably being created by the abnormal clonal process, and that cytokines probably do play a part in terms of the suffering and symptoms that patients endure.
What's the usual pathophysiology? It seems like an obvious question, but of the splenomegaly, is it more cytokine or intermediate related or sort of neoplastic infiltration related?
Probably more of the latter. We don't fully understand, but we do recognize a few things. One, that in MPNs, particularly in myelofibrosis, the bone marrow becomes leaky. That cells that ordinarily stay put in the bone marrow leak out into the blood. So ordinarily in our bone marrow, the cells grow like grapes on the vine, and they grow on stroma. And when they're differentiated enough, they cut their bond from the grapevine, and then they get sucked up into circulation. Now, in myelofibrosis, we believe the grapes fall off the vine prematurely. Now, another area in the body where they like to reattach is the spleen. So we recognize now that a lot of the enlargement of the spleen has to do with those early cells, myelocytes, metamyelocytes, blasts, and other myeloid progenitors getting trapped in the spleen. Now, there has been in the past somewhat of a misperception that the spleen is enlarged to compensate for anemia. We recognize that that's probably not the case, in that one, the spleen is probably not producing any new red cells. There is hematopoiesis going on in the spleen, but it's ineffective. So there are cells that are growing and dividing in the spleen, but there's probably no net output from the spleen that we can find.
Let's talk about the pretty amazing data presented at ASCO, the two phase 3 trials.
To give you some perspective, many of us have worked on myelofibrosis for many years. My mentor, Ayelu Teferi, before him, Murray Silverstein, Lou Wasserman, people going back many years. And for a very long time, the only therapies that we could use for myelofibrosis were either off-label medicines indicated for other things, or we had clinical trials with medicines that were really being developed for other indications, being developed for anti-fibrosing agents, agents being developed for myelodysplastic syndrome, agents being developed for acute myeloid leukemia. So to some degree, we had to kind of beg, borrow, and steal, you know, to try to have medicines to test in these diseases. And in large part, those trials were unsuccessful. There might be modest benefits in terms of anemia, modest benefits in terms of enlarging the spleen, but again, very few things that one would ever consider to be standard therapy. Nothing was FDA approved. We really, in many ways, were kind of living in the shadows. Well, the 2005 discovery of the JAK2 V617F mutation really led to a lot of scientific excitement in the field. And it did also now allow a quote-unquote druggable target, in that there was something that drug developers could make that potentially would be targeted against the illness. So in that setting, ruxolitinib, the first of the JAK2 inhibitors, began testing at a joint phase 1-2 trial at MD Anderson at Mayo Clinic. And this was an inhibitor of the native JAK2, and now has been joined by several additional JAK2 inhibitors. So the session at ASCO was particularly exciting in that it was the first randomized phase 3 trials that have ever been done in myelofibrosis on any level, let alone the success that was seen. So the two studies that were presented were two important studies, the first of which I was one of the co-principal investigators, the PI, a good colleague, Serge Vrstavchuk from MD Anderson, was ruxolitinib versus placebo in patients with intermediate and high-risk myelofibrosis. And the study demonstrated very strongly the benefits which we had observed from the earlier phase 2 study, in that the agent was very potent in decreasing this massive splenomegaly that patients have with the illness, and that it was very potent in improving the significant symptoms that patients can suffer with the illness, the fatigue, the night sweats, the weight loss. We found patients were gaining weight who had lost weight prior to going on the study. Like the phase 2, we found that patients have improvement in cachexia, in abnormal decreases in their cholesterol, that they experienced a whole range of very significant benefits. And compared to placebo was a striking difference, kind of a 42% hitting the primary goal versus basically none in the placebo arm.
You know, sometimes it's hard to look at some of the reported data in trial, get a feel for what it means clinically. You talked about 42%. If I were to say to you or a fellow on rounds with you were to say, well, you know, roughly what fraction of patients improve? You know, kind of relates more to the waterfall concept.
Sure. Well, you know, as we look at drugs, we ask ourselves, does everyone benefit? Or is there a clear group that benefits and a clear group that doesn't? I'd say with both ruxolitinib and the other JAK2 inhibitors, we tend to see that the vast majority of patients have a benefit, and that the percentage of response is a little bit of an arbitrary line in the sand, and that as we look at, let's say, the benefit of enlarging of the spleen or symptoms, again, with a kind of a waterfall plot, we see that the majority of patients have a decrease in spleen size the majority have a decrease in their disease-related symptoms. The threshold for quote-unquote response was meant to parallel the International Working Group, kind of an independent group of which I am a member, response criteria for enlargement of the spleen. So that is meant to reflect the equivalent of a 50% decrease of the palpable component of the spleen, which was an arbitrary number that we as clinicians who treat the illness said, you know, if the spleen shrinks by 50%, that's meaningful. Likewise, the symptomatic benefit, again, was pretty much across the board, but we had an arbitrary cutoff that there was a 50% decrease in the accumulative score of the symptoms that patients had experienced.
And I really recommend anybody take a look at the presentations. And I don't recall ever seeing a waterfall plot like that, because the thing that you all did that was so cool was, you know, you had the patients who were treated and the patients who weren't treated in the same slide. And the thing was dramatic. I mean, we've seen with TKIs, you know, whatever, you know, situations where most patients benefit. But the amazing thing to me was what was going on in the control group. I mean, they got worse.
Correct. Absolutely.
And you could see it right there on the curve.
Absolutely. The other study which was presented, which was a very, very interesting complement, was the European version of the study. So in the European version of the study, led by Claire Harrison from London, was ruxolitinib versus a physician's choice of alternative therapy. So patients were randomized. You know, you went in and you said, if the patient does not receive the study drug, then I choose the patient to go on hydroxyurea. And then the patient be randomized and they'd either get the drug or the hydroxyurea. And even against an active control arm, the results basically were interchangeable. Dramatic difference in terms of improvement in the size of the spleen, dramatic difference in terms of improvement in symptoms. And this is versus the very best available therapy that the clinicians could come up with. So showing a real strong incremental benefit over what was really existing in their kind of therapeutic armamentarium.
Yeah, it was very interesting to see these complementary, the Comfort 1 and Comfort 2 studies. There were a couple of interesting things about the way the Comfort 1 study in the U.S. was done that I wanted to ask you about. One was the use of MRI to evaluate the spleen. Can you talk about that? And do you think that that's just a research tool, or is there a role for that in clinical practice?
So it's a good question. You know, as we look at the many ways that the JAK2 inhibitors can be helpful, spleen being certainly a key component of that, you know, we recognize that the old way we used to do trials, the many phase 2 studies we did before this, needed room for improvement in terms of scientific research, where we would measure the size of the spleen by examination. Now, the difficulty with using physical exam is that it's tough to be exactly reproducible, and it, you know, the spleen moves up and down depending upon how deep a breath a patient takes in, is it measured exactly the same, and if the investigator is away the day, you know, the patient returns and a co-investigator is measuring, do they measure it in exactly the same way? So a whole variety of reasons, it becomes difficult to be exactly reproducible. So in that, both the ruxolitinib study and others have looked at volumetric MRI. So it's a much faster MRI in that it's not trying to distinguish fine detail, but is trying to have the radiologist basically just give you a volume in cubic centimeters of the size of the spleen. And that really gives much more accurate information. Now, I do think that this is primarily a research tool, however, in that it's meant to generate really clean data in terms of changes in the spleen that you can really hang your hat on and compare between centers.
So one question I can hear every oncologist listening to this driving on the roads of America asking is, when is it going to be available?
Well, it's a good question. Certainly, there are several JAK2 inhibitors. Ruxolitinib is the one furthest in development. You know, others clearly important to mention are CYT387, which is undergoing evaluation at SBio1518, TG101348, and several others that are even a little further behind in development, such as NS018, OY2784544, a whole variety of different agents in development. I'd say the first one, the one that has been now with a completed phase 3 study, certainly is undergoing a review. And if favorable, I could envision that that could potentially be available in the near future, whether that be, you know, Q1 2012, always many variables in terms of any sort of estimate.
What about toxicity? I thought that was also very interesting. And I can see that this is not necessarily going to be, you know, that easy for an oncologist to use. They're going to need to know what happens.
Sure. So in terms of toxicities, both with ruxolitinib, but the JAK2 inhibitors as a class, normal hematopoiesis does involve some signaling through JAK2. So normal processes of JAK2, erythropoietin, GCSF, thrombopoietin, they all stimulate hematopoiesis by going through JAK2. Now, the rationale of JAK2 inhibitors, which are inhibitors of the native JAK2, because it's not been able to be developed yet an agent that will be specific for the mutant JAK2, in part because it's just a point mutation, but inhibitors of native JAK2 can inhibit hematopoiesis to some degree. Now, the rationale has always been thought that aberrant cells with the MPNs will possibly be more sensitive to inhibiting JAK2, and that's why the activity and the benefit that we see. So with that, the toxicity that is seen across the spectrum of MPNs to some degree is variable degrees of myelosuppression. Now, with all the JAK2 inhibitors, we found that there is a real dose dependency issue with each of them, that there's a balance as to how much JAK2 inhibitor can be used to get the benefit without dropping the red cell count or causing anemia and without causing thrombocytopenia. So for most of them, including ruxolitinib, the DLT, or dose-limiting toxicity, in the phase 1s was thrombocytopenia. With the randomized study, we had already found out kind of what the optimal dosing was, and there was two different dose levels depending upon an individual's platelet count, and found that the prevalence of anemia or thrombocytopenia were uncommon, clearly less than 20%, and in some cases less than 10%. And two did require some both initial dose selection and a dose modification if that occurred.
Now, I think a lot of patients at the time these data were reported in June were still on treatment. But what do we know in terms of the duration of response and theoretically the recommended duration of treatment? Is it just until progression?
I'd say at this point that's probably the case. We know that the majority of people, even from our phase 2 study, remain on therapy. And that phase 2 study started back in 2007. The vast majority of people on the COMFORT 1 and 2 studies remain on therapy. I'd say that JAK2 inhibitors in general, as a suppressive therapy, probably when an individual has a response, they probably will remain on the agent until the time of progression. In myelofibrosis, we still have to contemplate what do we think progression means. Is it the spleen regrowing to the size that it was before? Is it the development of a different problem, such as increasing blasts or increasing anemia? All those, I think, are questions we need to look at.
So we work a lot with your colleague Rafael Fonseca in myeloma. And, of course, we're talking all the time there about lenalidomide. But I also see the IMiDs are being studied in myelofibrosis. What do we know about this? And what might be the mechanism of anti-tumor activity there?
All three of the IMiDs, thalidomide initially, and then lenalidomide, and now pomalidomide, have been active both in myeloma and in myelofibrosis. We suspect that they probably have been active for separate reasons. So the IMiDs have a variety of effects, but they certainly impact cytokines, and their benefit in myelofibrosis in particular has largely been improvement in cytopenias, so anemia and thrombocytopenia. So the current speculation is that inhibition of cytokines, TNF-alpha, perhaps other cytokines, change the bone marrow milieu and allow for more effective hematopoiesis to occur. So we had done studies with thalidomide, just low dose of thalidomide, and it was helpful, but neuropathy really being the limiting factor. We had successful studies with lenalidomide, and interestingly, like patients with myelodysplastic syndrome, individuals who have the deletion 5q can have very significant benefits.
Deletion 5q myelofibrosis?
Yes. So just like there's deletion 5q that can be present in MDS, there is a subset of patients with myelofibrosis who also have the deletion 5q. And these are individuals who are scrutinized up and down and clearly have a myelofibrosis phenotype, are not MDS patients. But clearly they share features and biologically may have overlapping features.
What fraction is 5q?
Oh, it's clearly less than 10%. It's a small number. But when it occurs, they tend to be quite sensitive because the target for lenalidomide, whatever it is, in Del5q patients remains. Now, lenalidomide in other myelofibrosis patients can be helpful, but the myelosuppressive effects of lenalidomide sometimes can be limiting. So in that environment, we tested pomalidomide, which is obviously being tested extensively now in myeloma as well. And we found that low doses of pomalidomide have been helpful in improving particularly anemia and transfusion dependence and have been very, very well tolerated, just a half a milligram of pomalidomide a day. So that too now is undergoing really what is the third open randomized registration trial in myelofibrosis, which is pomalidomide versus placebo in an international study in 200 plus patients to try to prove the impact of pomalidomide on patients specifically with anemia in myelofibrosis.
Can you envision a clinical situation outside a protocol setting? Maybe you've done this, I don't know, where assuming you could get access to one of the IMIDs, more likely the two that are available, that you would consider, or have you utilized these off study?
Yeah, so I would say in terms of my preferred non-study regimens, seeing many patients who are international patients, many patients in which enrollment in a clinical trial is not practical for a variety of reasons, or they just don't meet the sometimes stringent criteria for enrollment. Thalidomide and prednisone is particularly helpful for individuals with very severe thrombocytopenia with myelofibrosis. I put someone on this yesterday itself with platelet transfusion dependence with anemia. Lenalidomide, I view for off-study, particularly if there's a deletion 5q anywhere in the karyotype, so it can be, they can have various karyotypic abnormalities and a deletion 5q, or if they have refractory anemia. And lenalidomide, unlike thalidomide, sometimes can help with splenomegaly. So they have anemia and splenomegaly. Lenalidomide has been one of my trial choices for off-study regimens.
So I know you kind of prepared three clinical scenarios that would make useful teaching points. Maybe you can go through each one of those pretty briefly. First, the patient with PV.
Sure. So the first scenario I said was you have a patient for polycythemia vera. You've had it for 10 years. And now they come in to see you with a typical scenario for the last 6 months. My spleen's been enlarging. I'm having some night sweats. I've lost some weight. I'm having problems with itching. And then you wonder, where do they stand? So you perform a bone marrow biopsy. And now that you see, they have post-PV myelofibrosis. So the point I wanted to illustrate with this case is recognizing that early cases, ET and PV, have a natural history that can lead to disease progression. And patients with PV, we have now consensus criteria that when there's a clear increase in fibrosis in the bone marrow, but it goes along with a clear phenotypic change, such as enlargement of the spleen, a lot of symptoms, frequently a resistance to hydrea, or I should say more accurately, they become intolerant to hydrea. Let's say they had been on hydrea to control their blood counts for many years. And then now with that, we see that their blood counts have normalized. We take the hydrea away and their blood counts remain normal or continue to go down. So I'd say this is a key case of post-PV myelofibrosis. Now, these individuals, splenomegaly and a lot of symptoms, I'd say would be probably the ideal group that either for trial or if and when commercially available, benefit in particular from the JAK2 inhibitors. Patients with post-PV myelofibrosis tend to very rarely have anemia. It tends to not be a big factor with these individuals because they typically preserve some degree of increased erythropoiesis from before. So as we look at what's the big difference between having post-PV myelofibrosis and, let's say, primary myelofibrosis or post-ET myelofibrosis, patients with post-PV myelofibrosis rarely have anemia. So this group with lots of splenomegaly, lots of symptoms, if they're not moving toward acute leukemia, their blasts are not increased, this is a group who I think are almost custom-made for the benefits that we can see with JAK2 inhibition.
How about toxicities with JAK2 in the post-PV situation? Are they less, the same?
To some degree, I would say that they're less.
It seems like they would be.
Yeah, that the cytopenias are rarely an issue. The other toxicity that can occur with JAK2 inhibitors in some is GI toxicity. Some of them are FLT3 inhibitors. So ones that are not include ruxolitinib and CYT387. So not a lot of GI toxicity, meaning diarrhea, nausea, things of this nature. Others are FLT3 inhibitors, CEP701, SBIO1518, TG101348. And in this group of individuals, they typically are manageable, but they do have definite GI toxicity. And there's no differential in the GI toxicity amongst the different subtypes of myelofibrosis.
And when you talk about GI toxicity for practical purposes, are you talking about diarrhea or what?
Mainly diarrhea. So diarrhea and some nausea. You know, milder than, you know, let's say the big gun, you know, irinotecan, you know, these sorts of colorectal cancer drugs, nowhere near that range, but as a chronic oral therapy, typically do need some intervention. They do need some loperamide. They may need some compazine. They sometimes do need some medical assistance.
How about your second clinical scenario, the patient with primary myelofibrosis who's transfusion dependent?
So this is kind of another key phenotype. There's individuals between the two types who have a really big spleen. There's individuals who have a lot of anemia, and there's individuals who have both. But there are individuals in which the driving difficulty they have overlaps with myelodysplastic syndrome in terms of really a profound red cell transfusion dependence. So this is an individual primary myelofibrosis. They come in and they show you that they've had 80 units of red cells. They're getting red cells every 2 to 4 weeks. This individual is needing 2 units of blood per month. They have a high ferritin and they're very frustrated. This is a difficult group of patients to assist. The anemia from myelofibrosis can be multifactorial, and one needs to look at the reasons in the individual. One, they can have myelosuppression from prior therapy. So let's say they're on Hydrea. Hydrea certainly can be worsening the anemia, and one needs to question, do they need to remain on the Hydrea? Two, they might have occult GI bleeding, and that certainly needs to be considered. Three, with myelofibrosis, they clearly can have ineffective production of red cells. So with the marrow fibrotic process, and with a chronic leukemia, they can clearly have lack of production. And then finally, if the spleen is massively enlarged, they can have sequestration of red cells into the spleen and have anemia. So one needs to correct those things that are correctable. Two, if they're profoundly iron deficient, maybe they need iron. If they're GI bleeding, clearly that needs to be corrected. But let's say all of those things are corrected and it's truly because the marrow is not producing enough, then off-study therapies that have been beneficial have been, one, erythropoietin, particularly in people who have chronic renal insufficiency or have low EPO levels. You know, I'd say the MDS guidelines are almost superimposable in terms of the anemia and the EPO guidelines. Two, as I mentioned, thalidomide and lenalidomide sometimes have been helpful. And another agent that sometimes have helped is danazol. Maybe that's because of testosterone replacement, but those have been the most helpful off-study regimens. This is a scenario that on clinical trials, we have the clinical trial open. It's open at many centers in the U.S. is the pomalidomide registration study. Again, pomalidomide versus placebo.
So how about your third scenario, the patient with post-essential thrombocytopenic myelofibrosis?
So this is the most challenging group. An individual patient post-ET myelofibrosis, he's had it for 6 years, and now comes in with severe thrombocytopenia. He has 14% circulating blasts, but his marrow clearly shows that he's changed to acute myeloid leukemia. So the first question is this a patient who can undergo allotransplant? We published before in Blood that when individuals change to acute leukemia, their life expectancy is 2 to 3 months, and that very aggressive therapy, if it is appropriate, should be undertaken, or if it is not appropriate, either clinical trial or hospice would be wise. But let's say this individual is 54 and had a sibling match. First, we recognize and we have submitted data to hopefully present at the American Society of Hematology, the experience from our center. And the experience at our center is, first, patients need to get back to a chronic phase of the illness. They need to receive induction chemotherapy or some equivalent, whether it be azacitidine or some other therapy, to knock the blast back down to a normal level. And then go immediately to an allotransplant. At our center, we found that 75% of individuals in which this occurred who were transplant candidates, we were able to get them induced and successfully through an allotransplant and are disease-free. Those who failed were individuals in which the went to transplant not being clearly in a remission. So we know if we transplant people without induction in this setting, in the face of acute leukemia, they relapse and their disease comes back and they pass away. But two, we found even if you end up somewhere in the middle, let's say 12% blast after therapy, and you go to allotransplant, it's probably not active enough on its own. So these scenarios are very life-threatening, and they require very rapid induction followed by allotransplant, and at this point probably is the only curative path for this tough group.